This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jim Jarmusch, is one of the most respected independent filmmakers in America. He wrote and directed such films as Coffee and Cigarettes, Ghost Dog, Dead Man, Down by Law, and Stranger Than Paradise. His new film, Broken Flowers, won the Grand Prix at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It stars Bill Murray as Don Johnston, a man who made a lot of money in the software business and leads a pretty empty life sitting home in front of a big state-of-the-art TV. His latest girlfriend has just walked out on him. But soon he gets a mysterious, unsigned letter from a former lover who claims that Johnston unknowingly fathered a son with her and that this teenage son has left home and may be searching for his father. Don Johnston has no idea which of his exes from that era of his life wrote the letter. His neighbor convinces him to go on a road trip visiting each of the exes who might have written it. In this scene, Murray is visiting a former lover played by Sharon Stone. They're sitting at the dinner table along with her seductive teenage daughter, who is named Lolita.
So what, where do you work?
Oh, Mom has her own business, right?
Yeah. Really?
I'm a professional closet organizer.
Come on.
Oh, I organize people's closets. I even do their drawers. I label everything. I get them all organized. I even color coordinate them.
Yeah, and they pay her for that. It's amazing.
Lolita. I said you could have a taste. No, come on. That's enough of that. That's not cool.
Lolita. Interesting choice of name, Laura.
What?
Jim Jarmusch told me that the film's premise of tracking down old girlfriends was suggested to him by a couple of friends. I asked if the idea of revisiting his early life by tracking down old girlfriends was a compelling fantasy for him.
No, it's not. In fact, it's pretty foreign to me because I generally don't like looking back. I don't like going into the past. I adamantly refuse to look at my films once they're finished, for example. I've never gone back and looked at them. It's funny, it's not really the elements of the story are not personal to me. The paternity thing is not some driving thing for me. This looking back is not something really in my nature. So it's kind of odd. It was also very odd for me to start a story with a character that I didn't connect with really at all. And I've never really done that before. Other characters I write, you know, even if they're damaged or twisted in some way, I feel for them. You know, I have some love for them. And Don Johnston, you know, I just could care less. I feel a million miles away from him in the beginning of the story. So it was kind of odd for me. But it did lead me to something interesting. After I finished shooting and I was pretty exhausted, I went straight into the editing with Jay Rabinowitz, who I edit with, and I walked in and said, Jay, you know, I think we have to edit this film backwards and start with the ending because it's a delicate film to build and I designed it so that I don't, for some reason, care for the character in the beginning. So we actually edited the film in reverse and didn't really see it from front to back until like 6 weeks into the cutting.
And what did that do for you, editing it that way?
It helped me find out where the guy was going, because it is a kind of a quiet, delicate film, the way I see it, and it's kind of accumulative. And it's also one reason I wrote it, you know, thinking of Bill, because I know Bill Murray could pull this off. So it allowed us to find a kind of emotional tone where the film was going to, rather than start from the beginning. And, you know, it's very odd. This film, if someone else edited it, it could have been had a very, very different tone. So I was very, very careful about the tone of the film emotionally and the actors' little moments, and just kind of, you know, picking the right takes and moments was very, very delicate, more so than other films I've made.
There's a scene where Bill Murray is just sitting still in his living room, and he's playing a Marvin Gaye record.
Yeah.
And we hear the entire song as he basically continues to sit still. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene and why you wanted to? I mean, it's what, a 2.5-3 minute song. Nothing happens except Bill Murray continues to sit there. And it's a wonderful film moment, and at the same time, it's a kind of almost anti-film moment because it's so static.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you mentioned it because in a lot of ways, it's my favorite scene in the film. It's the song I Want You, Marvin Gaye, and we didn't use the entire song because I think it's 5-6 minutes long, but it's a good minute and a half, 2 minute scene of Bill Murray's character, Don Johnston, just sitting in his house. He has a bottle of champagne opened, a glass of champagne poured, which he never touches, and this whole trip has been designed for him by his neighbor, Winston, played by Jeffrey Wright, to visit these old girlfriends, and he keeps saying, I'm not doing this, I would never do this, but we kind of see that he's becoming a little bit obsessed or preoccupied. And this scene is kind of his little space where he's really contemplating this thing. And so I didn't want it to say really anything but that. And Bill did such beautifully minimal things with his hands. At one point, he maybe appears to maybe reach for the champagne glass, but decides against it. And he's just kind of drifting around with this very lush kind of romantic sexual music, swirling around him. And I don't know, I like that scene a lot. It's really a kind of insight into his stasis as a character and his past by the music. And I don't know, I was very, really happy with Bill, what he did with very tiny things.
It's scenes like that that make me think of your movies as like poems. And I don't mean that like, oh, it's so poetic. But I mean, in the sense that a lot of your movies are really about tones and moods and moments more than they are about long, complicated narratives.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, and I think of my work when I do think of it, comparing it to books in a bookstore, I really think of my films as sort of slim volumes of poetry in the back of the store rather than like the big bestsellers being displayed in the front, so I do take that as a compliment, and I do hope my films have something poetic rather than prosaic about them. But again, I don't want to go too far analyzing them myself. But, they are sort of cumulative, and small things resonate, hopefully. It's odd to me. Like, I think that Broken Flowers is a kind of sad film, but it has a lot of funny stuff in it, but I don't think of it really as a comedy. And yet audiences are finding it very funny, which is I like very much, because the humor in the film isn't the result of like gags or big jokes, but of small behavioral, things people do. So I'm really happy that they find it funny, but there's something else in it besides being funny for me. And also, the ending of the film is, it doesn't really wrap things up, and I think it leaves people in a place where they can't quite immediately formalize their reaction, and I also like that a lot.
The movie stars Bill Murray, who was also featured in your previous film, Coffee and Cigarettes. What were the qualities you saw in him that you wanted to work with?
Well, I think he is really one of our finest actors of, he can do things so, I don't know how to put it, he never pushes anything when he's playing, if you don't want him to. And the smallest reactions are so expressive and complete. And it's funny because, people keep saying, oh, well, Bill Murray, now he's gone into this other mode and Rushmore and Lost in Translation and The Life Aquatic and now Broken Flowers. He's looking for this other part of himself. But, I don't really see that. I see that he's been working on that all along. And I know that he came from Second City and he learned to react to things very quickly. And he is very, very observant of other people, he's very sensitive to other people and what they feel. So I think he's been doing this for quite a while. And what I think is funny is that, maybe younger people will know him more from Wes's films and Sophia's film and my film, and then we'll find out, you know, wait, you mean that's the guy that was in, like, Caddyshack and Meatballs, you know? And that might be part of Bill's master plan. I don't know. But I think he's been, you know, developing this very delicate side of his acting ability for a long time. And I just kind of reduced it maybe even further than some of the previous characters he played, and kept him very, very minimal, and just let his face and his instincts, you know, guide his reactions as an actor. So he really came out with a beautiful performance.
Now, what about directing him? Were there certain, is directing him different than directing other actors?
Well, all directing all actors, it's different for every actor. You know, there is no one way to direct actors, and there's no one way for one director to direct all actors. So you find something, a way to collaborate with each person that's very different, and they come from different, you know, different procedures. Bill doesn't like to rehearse. He likes to talk about the character. He likes to talk about things that maybe don't even immediately relate to the character, but lead us to the character. Bill and I prepared by talking a lot. We took one long walk about 2 or 3 hours through Manhattan at night one night, and that was our biggest collaboration in terms of finding the character. And then on the set, you know, you just have to make Bill, you have to allow him to walk in and have it fresh, you know. And he stayed very close to the dialogue in the script, which was sort of surprising to me, because I kept thinking, but don't you want to make it better? Can't you, you know, help me with this dialogue? And often he'd say, no, this is good. I like this. So he stayed pretty close to the dialogue in the script. And but, you know, other actors that he had scenes with, like Jeffrey Wright, who's an amazing actor, he has a very different process. He likes to prepare and go over the scene and the lines. And Bill, you can't do that, because that will kill the scene for Bill. So, you know, it's a tricky thing in directing any actor. You know, you're part psychologist, but you're really collaborating with them. So you have to find the way that the two of you can approach the character together. And really, it's way different for every actor.
Lynn Hirschberg wrote a profile of you recently in the New York Times Magazine, and she described you as the last major truly independent filmmaker in America. Do you feel that way about yourself?
I try not to think about myself in that kind of wide perspective, and no, I don't think that way, because my definition of independent is, you know, the originator of the story of the film, being it's, you know, having control over it creatively. And there are a lot of people who do that, and people are able to do that even in sort of studio conditions. I mean, the Coen brothers and Spike Lee, who are sort of my generation, have been able to do that. And there are a lot of younger directors like Sophia and Wes Anderson and P.T. Anderson and Alexander Payne that I think have final cut over their films, or are, you know, completely responsible for them. If so, they are independent to me. So I, you know, I'm not even sure if that's the same definition other people would use, but because I think of myself as an amateur filmmaker, in that I do it because I love the form, rather than a professional filmmaker that does it as, you know, as my career or for my profession. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to react to that, and I kind of live in my own little sphere as far as, you know, where my place in the world. That always seems very strange to me and kind of funny.
Since some of your films are about changing the subject a little bit, since some of your films are about facing death or facing that life itself can sometimes feel like a void, I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about death. I know you worked with Nicholas Ray, who's the great director whose films included Rebel Without a Cause and Johnny Guitar. And you worked, I think, as an assistant to him when he had cancer and was,
yes,
facing death. How did he handle it? Like, what did he was, I'm sure, an idol of yours. What was it like to not only be working with one of the people who you idolized, but who was also dying at the same time?
Well, you know, it was pretty heavy, but the thing is that Nick stayed so full of life until the very end, and there were times in you know, you'd be sitting with him on some afternoon, and he would just suddenly double up and curl up in intense, excruciating pain and couldn't breathe, and he just wanted to be left alone in those periods, and then he'd sort of come back. And then he'd start talking animatedly about whatever it was you were talking about before. And he was so, I don't know, he was so interested in expression on all levels, on all forms. You know, he early on he did a radio show playing rural blues and prison songs and, you know, kind of Alan Lomax recordings. And, you know, he was a friend of Bertolt Brecht, and, you know, he was just interested in so many things. At the same time, I know he used to play tennis in Hollywood with Hollywood moguls, and, you know, he had a very interesting life, but he was very open, and so I don't know. It was hard, and I stayed in his house while he was in the hospital. His wife, Susan, asked me to stay in the house and answer the phone because she would sleep in the hospital, and I'd visit him also a few times in the hospital right up until his death. So it was rough, and yet at the same time somehow really inspiring, you know, to just to have contact with somebody like that. That you, I did idolize his work, and I still do.
Are there other people who you knew at the time that they were dying who made an impression on you in terms of like how they faced it?
Well, my grandmother was 99 when she died. She was a big inspiration to me growing up. She was a very feisty woman, a retired school teacher that, you know, made her living by selling antiques out of her basement and stuff like that. And she got me interested in Native culture, in French literature, in certain impressionistic paintings, and, you know, when I was a young teenager. And when she died, I remember on her 99th birthday, my uncle, my mother's twin brother, said, "Wow, next year you're going to be 100. They'll put you in the newspaper, and you might even be on TV." And my grandmother said, "Well, I'll be damn sure to die before that happens." And she did, but she had to kind of starve herself. And her mother had been 101 when she died, my great-grandmother, and she didn't want to be that. She said, "I don't want to be that old." And so she kind of went out, and she starved herself and then had a stroke. And I used to visit her and hold her hand, and she'd look in my eyes, and I knew exactly. She would just said, "I just want to go now," you know? And her body wouldn't even let her. It took a while, and then she did die. But that was also a kind of inspiring death in a way, because she had lived such a full life, but she just adamantly didn't want to be around much longer. So she made her own choice in that way.
Several of your films are just so urban. You're really associated as a filmmaker who's captured like an urban experience. And you've moved to the Catskill Mountains for at least part of the time. You don't live there all the time, but part of the time. Why did you want to spend part of your time in the country?
Well, I like contrasts, and I love cities. I really love cities. They're like lovers you've had or have, and there's so many different qualities to different cities that I really love. But I also love, like, you know, I love the natural landscape, and I really do think that the cycles of nature, you can learn more from them than from most human expression. So I like the balance. I also love how quiet it is. I love being able to read and listen to music and, you know, do write and do things, let my imagination go without all the noise, both literally and figuratively, of the city. It also deepens my appreciation of the city, because when I come back in, then there are a lot of things I want to do that I might not have done if I'd been here. I might just hide out if I stay here. But I also like wild animals and plants and mushroom identification and you know, bird identification. And so there's a lot of things going on out there that give me a lot. You know, sometimes I feel like the city, it gave me so much energy when I was younger that now maybe it's starting to call in its chips. You know, it's starting to take energy from me. So I get a good balance by being kind of isolated in the woods for half the time.
Jim Jarmusch, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me back.
Jim Jarmusch wrote and directed the new film Broken Flowers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.